to order this January 23rd, 2018 work session.
I do, right over there, there's a whole bunch.
I would like to open this work session to the Lane County Planning Commission. This work session, we will be discussing the transportation systems plan implementation project. We've all received the information and have had some time to digest it. And at this time, I'll turn it over to Emma Newman, the City of Springfield Senior Planner, and Becky Taylor on behalf of Lane County. She's Lane County Senior Planner. So, over to you two.
Thank you. Good evening, Commissioners and Chairs. This evening, as Chair James just explained, the Transportation System Plan Implementation Project is before you. In 2014, the Transportation System Plan itself was co-adopted by the city and the county. And in that plan, there are identified policies and next steps to further implement the Transportation System Plan. So that's what this evening is about. There are three components. There's proposed amendments to the Springfield Development Code, adoption of the conceptual street map, and some changes to the Transportation System Plan project list and maps to help further implement the policies that were already adopted. On November 21st, 2017, the Springfield Planning Commission met in work session to review and discuss the draft materials. Since then, additional changes have been made based on some of the feedback that we received at that meeting. I'd like to briefly highlight those changes for you. They're available in Attachment 1, the Planning Commission Memo attachment. So changes to the Springfield Development Code, which is Attachment 3 in your packet. We updated the language to reflect the Planning Commission feedback to use the idiom people with disabilities instead of disabled persons, and that was in one section of the development code that we are proposing changes to. And then we have incorporated some content from the Engineering Design Standards and Procedures Manual regarding lighting standards, medians, sidewalks, and multi-use paths. So that language was residing in the EDSPM, but it's more appropriate to be located in the Springfield Development Code. So we've brought that text in for this draft that's before you this evening. The second component is the conceptual street map. A substantive edit that we made was to add two local conceptual streets shown on either end of East 20th Avenue in Glenwood. This was based on feedback that we received from a property owner along that street. He had discussed with staff previously, and it was the type of thing that we would have suggested if we had seen it and considered it in the draft development process. So that's been added into the draft before you this evening to help improve street connectivity and not have an isolated public street with no access to the other public streets. Lastly, there are a few typo edits. T Street did not connect through, so we've adjusted that, and the North Bank Path was not shown as existing facilities, so those have been edited on this draft as well. Third is the TSP project list and figure amendments. There was one typo. We had been showing R8, Mallard Avenue, a collector roadway project, connecting all the way through in the originally adopted TSP. We were showing it as a change, but that was not intentional, so it's reverted back to the already adopted project. Any questions so far with those changes? Okay, great. Next, I'd like to move on to public involvement and community feedback. So I know that was an item that you were hoping to hear more from in your last work session. The Stakeholder Sounding Board did additional review and provided more feedback on the conceptual street map, and their comments from the members who provided input were included with the email correspondence packet available on the webpage. We also mailed public notice to all property owners within the Springfield Urban Growth Boundary, and this was a joint notice with the city and the county, in accordance with ballot measure 56 and state statute requirements. In that notice, the open house was publicized, as well as this evening's public hearing at 7 o'clock. The open house was hosted on January 9th, and there were over 100 attendees. It was an opportunity for people to drop in and ask staff questions, clarify the proposed changes, and get more information. Additional follow-up via phone, email, and meetings have occurred since then. There have been, I would say, approximately 400 additional communications with community members regarding the public notice and proposed changes in addition to the open house participation. So we're up at about 500 contacts or more. There were probably another 30 today that came in. The highlights are included in attachment one in the Planning Commission memo, some specific topics that were brought up, and then we've also been continuing to receive feedback, so we'll be including that in the next packet as well, compiling all of the public comment. The records from the open house, the comment forms, the emails, and the letters received are available in their original form on the project webpage, so that's available. I think Mark can show that, but all of you have a link to the webpage in your packet. So down where it says read comments received from the public open house here, and read comments received by email and mail. That's where all of the comments received prior to or on January 11th have been compiled, and we'll be updating that again prior to your next meeting on the 6th. And with that, unless there are any questions, I would like to turn it over to Becky to speak some county-specific items.
Good evening, commissioners. Again, I'm Becky Taylor. I'm a senior transportation planner with Lane County. And as a reminder, Lane County's role in the process is to co-adopt the proposed amendments to Springfield's transportation system plan and the Springfield Development Code for applicability within the urbanizable area between the city limits and the urban growth boundary. Our Planning Commission has recently adopted other city transportation system plans for Eugene, Junction City in 2017, and Cottage Grove in 2016. So just as a reminder to our commission that we've done this for other cities recently. And also as a reminder, we processed the TSP amendment package as an amendment to the Metro Plan. You'll recall that process for Eugene in 2017. And as Emma said, Lane County did co-adopt Springfield's TSP in 2014, and she explained why they are amending the code and the TSP at this time to implement that 2014 TSP. I've looked through the amendment package, honing in on the urban transition area for implications, and I've outlined those in your memo. I've summarized the amendments as they relate to the TSP on page 2 of your memo and the code amendments on page 3. And this work session is your opportunity to ask any clarifying questions and also to prepare you for the public hearing tonight at 7 o'clock. Wanted to also remind you that this is a legislative decision rather than a quasi-judicial one, so you are free to ask staff questions throughout the work session. However, we would like you to hold off from making any recommended edits to the package until deliberations. And deliberations will not happen until after the second public hearing. Tonight is just the first of two public hearings. A second public hearing will be held on February 6th, and therefore no decisions are going to be made tonight. That concludes my staff presentation, and I'm open for questions.
One more item. One more item that I'd like to add and also speak to during the public hearing introduction is that we did meet with several property owners along the Main Street corridor, and Springfield has had ongoing planning efforts along Main Street, and the property owners were expressing concern primarily with regards to table 4.2-1 that speaks to minimum curb-to-curb width and right-of-way widths. So staff would like to propose this new language that's highlighted as a footnote in green that specifies for the arterial section of the table, saying that arterials that are Oregon Department of Transportation, ODOT, facilities are not subject to the standards in table 4.2-1, but must meet ODOT design standards. So I will provide a copy to all of you on this. And then lastly, the approval criteria for the Springfield Development Code and Lane Code state the amendment shall be consistent with the relevant statewide planning goals, and the adoption of the amendment shall not make the Metro Plan internally inconsistent. And for the Development Code amendments, the approval criteria state in reaching a decision to adopt or amend the Springfield Development Code, the council must adopt findings that demonstrate conformance to the following: 1, the Metro Plan; 2, applicable state statutes; and 3, applicable statewide planning goals and administrative rules. And with that, I'll turn it over to the chairs.
All right. This is our opportunity to pose questions to staff. So open the floor and Springfield Planning Commissioners, do you have any questions at this time for staff?
Yes. Three items I'm still concerned about. One was the parking credit issue, and I noticed in one spot I read that there was a required reserve someplace, and when I went back through the packet, I didn't find that language again. It was saying that some areas would need to be held in reserve to make sure that the credits worked and that the parking actually wasn't needed. That was one. The second was regarding bike parking. And I did see that there were some changes for long-term versus short-term, but I still think we are shorting our long-term bicycle parking. As a long-time bicycle commuter, I recognize the need for long-term bicycle parking. I don't think short-term is as needed in many cases. And then the last item, and I brought this up in a work session, was regarding sidewalks, which was on page 36 of the attachment, which stated that obstructions, which was including flush mount utilities, would need to be moved out of the sidewalk for sidewalk construction. And I think that that wording is somehow real bad, that water mains, valves, manholes, and junction boxes should certainly be allowed in the sidewalk. If they need to have like a non-slip texture or something put on them, that's one thing. But to actually state in the code that those structures, flush mount structures, would actually need to be moved on the sidewalk would be a tremendous expense that, to my opinion, would not increase safety. So I really think that language should change.
Okay.
Would you like us to respond, or do you want to discuss amongst yourselves?
I think it would be good for you to respond.
Okay. I'm not sure exactly the section of the parking credit comment that you provided was in, so I don't know if other staff in the room might be able to help identify that location.
So 4.6.1.10 on attachment 3, page 45 of 87, subsection B. I'm wondering if this is what you're referring to. If parking has been provided to serve an existing use, the number of parking spaces cannot be reduced as a result of the fewer spaces than required by this section, except as parking reductions are allowed below and under the special provisions to table 4.6-2. Is that the section that you were thinking of?
No, this did speak of a parking reserve, that they would actually reserve areas of the development if parking was needed. They would be granted a reduction in parking based on like proximity to transit, etc. But they would be required to actually hold a reserve area to increase the numbers of parking stalls should it prove that the reduction wasn't warranted later. I can't find it again.
I don't believe there are any changes to those reductions between the commission's last work session and now. Personally doesn't ring a bell for the language that we had and took out. So if you could follow up by email directly to staff if you find that reference.
Okay.
That'll be helpful.
Yes.
Is it possible that what you're talking about is attachment 3, page 44 at the bottom?
I don't think so. I'll try to find it. Sorry.
That would be helpful. Thank you.
Okay.
With regards to the bike parking question and expressing a desire for more long-term parking, we do have provisions in the code that once the short-term parking gets up to a certain number, then some of that starts to be covered and starts to act in some ways like long-term parking with some of those amenities, such as being out of the rain. But that being said, if the commission would like to provide direction to further increase long-term parking, that would be something that would be good to discuss. And if you have specific uses that you think are needing adjustment, that would be helpful as well, so that we're not just going down the whole use table and converting it all to 100% long-term or something. We would like a little bit more direction as to how to implement that. And then with regards to sidewalks, Michael, would you like to speak to that item?
So I do believe you are correct that it is often convenient to cite things like water meters, junction boxes, and other utility things that can be made flush mount and can have the characteristics to them that allow for ADA acceptability. What we've found in practice through working through development and redevelopment and also just basic maintenance of a lot of these utilities is that as they age, they create problems when trying to maintain them, both in allowing users to still use the sidewalk as they are maintaining them and the additional joints and structures that are required for putting them in the sidewalk. So it's a longer term maintenance issue, and often specifically with ADA ramps, where SUB would have to come through and maintain them, or other entities, since essentially laying for telecom or other vaults like that, when they come in, they have to bring up the ramps and or sidewalks into ADA compliance, which means having to rebuild entire corners, which has been very cost prohibitive. And ADA regulations have been ever-changing, and there's ever threats of lawsuits associated with that. So the costs bared at that moment due to maintenance often outweigh the initial advantage you get to having them in those structures at that time. So it's something that right now when you're doing something, we try to plan to keep them out of there as much as possible, so in the future when they have to maintain them, replace them, or do anything, they're not affecting any of those structures, and then wouldn't have to rebuild entire intersections or corners to merely do maintenance. maybe it'd be great to have commentary in relation to SUB and some of the utilities as to the issues that they've had with finding lids and making them ADA accessible and fulfilling those requirements. And so this text is really meant to try to avoid future maintenance issues and future issues with bringing facilities into compliance in relation to those utilities and their flush service. We do recognize that there are places where we do not have sufficient right-of-way or we're just forced into that situation. And I think those are best to kind of be handled in a case-by-case basis. But the intent is to try to do everything we can to not cite them in there so we didn't have issues with having to move and detour people when they're maintained or bringing full structures into compliance.
All three of your
questions.
I have a question. Emma, in relation to, I'm looking at a matrix on page 41 of 43, and this is in regard to the comparing the TSP to TPR requirements, and you state in this matrix the proposed amendments to SDC 4.2.1 or -105 regarding minimum right-of-way and paving widths are intended to allow more flexibility for certain design elements or reduce paving width. For example, the current minimum right-of-way and paving width requirements do not distinguish between streets that provide on-street parking and those that do not. Proposed changes permit narrower streets than currently permitted when no on-street parking is planned or when planned for only one side of the street. I think that is a good comparator, but the reality of 4.2-105 and the cross sections that you provide for the street I'm on like page 20 or 13, attachment 3 through goes on through the 20s. The reality is that there is some flexibility, but this would require sidewalks on both sides of the street. Is that correct? Or could you have that revised with discretionary, going through a discretionary process? Or, you know, because there are times when it just does not make sense for a developer to put sidewalks on both sides of the street in steep terrain or things of that nature. Maybe you could speak to that.
Yeah, so the current minimum right-of-way and curb-to-curb widths do accommodate sidewalks on both sides, including the steep hillside condition that you see further down on the chart. The table as presented to you provides clarification as to whether on-street parking is intended to be provided on both sides, one side, or no sides, no on-street parking for the street. The current table that's in the code is here on your new handout as well, and just had one width listed and didn't provide that level of clarity talking about the different components of a street. The intent with this showing the sidewalk and bike facilities when applicable is to allocate space to that, but there are situations where you could have a specific street where it could be an off-street multi-use path that's next to the street that accommodates walking and biking and provides that component, but isn't necessarily as shown in the illustrative graphics.
And if I could follow up, your question was, could these elements be converted into a discretionary process? And the city could do that. Here's the legal reason not to propose it that way. Currently, under Oregon law, if there are non-discretionary citywide street standards, those are not subject to a constitutional takings analysis for exemptions if they are imposed through development review. So if we have a uniformly adopted and non-discretionary standard that applies to all new development, and we require a property owner to dedicate that right-of-way based on that standard, that is subject to a much higher standard of review for that takings analysis. And so if we introduce a discretionary process, then we have it's a higher burden to show that the right-of-way that's being required is specifically related to the development being proposed, which makes it difficult to adopt a uniform street network across the city.
Okay. Other questions? Yes.
A question for Becky. There's obviously a lot of public interest, a lot of public comment so far. 500, I think, was the number someone threw out. And Becky, I'm paraphrasing here, but I believe you said as a Lane County Planning Commissioner, I should be focusing my review on land that's outside the city limit, inside the urban growth boundary. So can we approximate the number of how many of the 500 comments might address land that falls in that loan? In that zone, are there a lot of folks in that transition area that have expressed strong interest in this process?
I don't know if we have exact numbers. I did review the comment log and tried to isolate how many of those individuals were in the county in the urban transition area. So that's the type of information that I'll be listening to when the public addresses you at the public hearing. I'll be making notes and I will do some follow-up to determine which of the testimony applies to the urban transition area. So I'll help you with that determination. But just kind of big picture, I attended the public open house and talked to lots of people in the urban transition area. I would say maybe 10. That's a lot for me for a planning. This public interest is so high in this amendment package, it's pretty unusual for other planning projects that involve public outreach that I've participated in. So you might hear from a lot of people tonight. But what the consistent theme that I heard from people in the urban transition area was fear of annexation, which is not included in this package. As part of the staff report before the public hearing, I'll be addressing my comments mainly for the public's benefit to clarify that they should be directing comments to the Lane County Commission for specific to the urban transition area, and then again confirming that this package does not include annexation. The other theme that I heard from the public was concern that the county and the city was going to build some of these planned projects right away and property impacts. And many of the projects are existing. As I outlined in your memo, there's very few new projects proposed in the urban transition area. And most of those would involve some kind of public outreach process to determine property impacts. And that level of detail isn't ready at this time, if that helps you any.
It does. Thank you. When we do get to the deliberation stage, I think it would be very helpful for me anyway, as a Lane County Planning Commissioner, to be able to have an easier visibility as to the concerns of those folks in the transition area.
Okay. I will be more than happy to create that for you, to isolate the public testimony specific to urban transition area residents.
If I'm the only one who feels that way, I can...
I'm with you.
Okay. Thank you.
I have a question which touches on the same subject. So I went through the notification of the public and I found the notice of public hearing postcard which was on the website. And I also observed and recorded that there were public comments, exactly like you just said, Becky, basically with people concerned about annexation. And obviously for much of what we're interested in for Lane County is the unincorporated areas. So can you speak a little bit about how we know that this got to the unincorporated areas and not just the city areas?
Emma assures me that this was mailed to everyone within
the... Okay. So to all property owners within the Springfield UGB. So it includes the urbanizable area outside the city limits, but within the county and within the Springfield UGB.
Okay.
And we base it on the tax assessor's records.
Yes.
Yeah, I've got three questions. The first one, I wasn't able to find the specific project list on my iPad, but I got it tonight. But the first question has to do with, I'm sure there's been coordination with the state, with ODOT. Are there any projects planned for reconfiguring the interchanges into the Glenwood area from I-5?
So this package that we have before you this evening does not include any changes for interchange area management plans or any of those facilities in Glenwood.
Is that in the future then, or?
There might be some existing study projects in the TSP that I could look into and get back to you.
Okay, yeah.
But there's no proposed changes right now.
Okay, yeah, please let me know where I might find that. Second question has to do back with the matrix that we passed out this evening. And I see that on the sheet that you handed us, Emma, it's listed as 4.2-105, which corresponds to table 4.2-1 in attachment 3 on page 15 and 16. They're the same, I guess one's an ordinance, maybe one's a plan. But in the table that's being replaced, travel lane widths are not identified, and they are in the new table. Specific travel lane widths. The old table just talks about minimum right-of-way and minimum curb-to-curb distances, and the new table has several additional design or dimensional features included. My first question is, these are minimums. So how, for example, let's just take travel lane widths for a major arterial, is 12 feet the minimum? And if it is, how does one go about getting a wider one? Who makes that determination?
Yes, so 12-foot would be the typical minimum on the ones that say 12-foot.
So they could be 13?
There could be wider lanes. I believe it would have to have a specific plan that's been adopted or a reason that the city would want additional right-of-way or the county would want additional right-of-way. Maybe Christina wants to weigh into legal aspects of this.
Well, let me jump right to the heart of the question. In the transitional areas, the urbanizable areas, as new streets are punched into those areas and development occurs, and specifically the local streets, which I assume could be the responsibility of the developer, the minimum width on that lane width is 10 feet. My first question there is that a new standard for the city of Springfield, minimum 10 feet for local roads?
I think in the city of Springfield, we have a wide range of local roads, and there definitely are places where when you exact what's the assumed 8-foot parking, that you would be left with 20 feet for bi-direction. You can see in the previous table, there's an option for a 28-foot curb-to-curb. We assume 8-foot parking with that, so that was a previous one where we assumed 20-foot for both lanes and 10-foot in each direction, which is acceptable in a local standard without truck movements and crossing in the volumes.
Okay, yeah, and that's where it really goes to, is truck traffic through these areas. So is it conceivable that a local road could have lane widths in excess of 10 feet?
It is conceivable if there was a rational reason to accommodate for that. It's typically, we're not trying to accommodate trucks through a local, so it'd have to be a very special case where there's a pre-existing non-conforming condition or something as part of review that necessitated a larger lane width.
Okay. Which takes me to my third question. Thanks very much. And again, it's in the transition area, specifically Glenwood, and specifically this 20th Street connection from McVeigh. Now it dead ends as you head west. You're proposing a connection to Nugget Way, which is an industrial local collector, local street.
Yep.
My question to you is, why would you want to introduce the possibility of industrial traffic diverting from or to Nugget Way through what is essentially a residential neighborhood right now on both sides of 20th Street?
Yes, so built as a local street, if it did turn into a full local street connection between Nugget Way and McVeigh Highway, that would be built to the local street standards, which are not going to be encouraging large-scale truck traffic. As I said, this edit was made in response to property owners along that street who said, we're basically in an island right now. If you dig into the paperwork, and I worked with the state surveyor, there is an easement for some uses to get into the public street, but right now it's an isolated local street that doesn't have any connectivity via a street connection to the other public streets in the area.
Still doesn't get to my question, though. You could divert industrial traffic from Nugget through the residential area to McVeigh and vice versa. And that, to me, just creates the potential for some hazards and issues there.
So I think one of the issues is the existing built environment associated with that stretch, in that houses were built across the entire middle part of the parcel. And there's emergency access needs that require a turnaround after a certain number of feet, 150 feet, which does not exist right now. So if there's a fire down at the end of it on one of the houses, there'd be no way for an emergency vehicle to turn around. And since the middle part is completely built, the only way to get through there to get secondary access or turnaround is just to build the other two ends. So it's kind of a consequence of the built environment that we showed both of those. Does that mean that in the future you couldn't have a situation where one end becomes a turnaround to block it off from industrial traffic going through? That would work, but that it'd have to comply with our standards for the longest you can have of a dead end road with a turnaround as well. And in this case, it was really a symptom of trying to deal with the built environment and the houses that are associated with that. I think Mark has bringing up the more of an aerial photo on the screen, which will kind of show that condition. It's kind of a special condition.
Yeah, I'm pretty familiar with it. Conceivably, yeah. Alternatively, could you just have a fire lane access from Nugget to 20th that's bulleted off?
There are options for that, but in relation to our code language for block links and other things, that would negate some of our options for block links in relation to local or industrial standards.
Thanks.
Mark, can you zoom in a little bit closer, please?
Yeah. Kind of hard to see, but it's existing access is off of McVeigh, and then it swoops around, comes back down as a gravel, and then terminates. So there really isn't an availability for a turnaround. It's a rather large block length.
Could a street like that be signed no through trucks?
We can always sign streets no through trucks.
Well, it introduces residential traffic into the industrial area too. Now, Nugget Way's already jammed up in that. Thanks. An issue.
Yep. All right. Other questions?
Yes.
I don't know how everyone else feels, but it seems really cold in here to me. And I don't know if staff has the capability to turn up the temperature a bit or not. If I'm the only one who feels that way, once again, I'm happy to put on another.
That's the issue you would know.
Thank you.
Thanks. Other questions?
Hearing none at this time. You have anything in closing?
Thank you. In closing, I'd like to just reiterate what Becky spoke to earlier, that we are going to have a second Planning Commission continued public hearing on February 6th, and I'll announce that as well. If you'd like additional items that come out of this evening's public hearing to be followed up on by staff, if you can indicate that at the end of the meeting, that would be very helpful so that we can bring you the additional information for that next meeting. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions?
Will that February 6th meeting be back here?
I believe. Is that correct?
7 o'clock.
Thank you.
Okay.
It's a joint.
Yes.
All right. The work session stands adjourned.
Becky, you'll get that information about the study for the interchange improvements.